With a 50% obesity rate in the U.S. and more unhealthy people than ever before, it is time to make America healthy. Welcome to Make America Healthy with Beth Shaw. If you're feeling tired, toxic, heavy, slow, or stressed, then keep listening. Beth and her expert guests are here to offer practical advice and share the tools you need to reclaim your physical, mental, and emotional health. Now, here is your host, Beth Shaw.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Make America Healthy. Our goal through Make America Healthy is to empower you with as much knowledge as possible on all aspects of health and wellness, physical, mental, emotional, energetic, so that you can make more informed decisions when it comes to taking control of your health on every level. And our episode today is Fit Over 50, and I'm very happy to have Dr. Maseen Habib with us, who has been on the show before, and he is a longtime doctor of anti-aging, and he's from the UK, runs Next Health, the first medical clinic to offer fitness, nutrition, and medical services under one roof. He's got a lot of degrees and does inflammation testing, cardiac testing, tests for cancer, and is very knowledgeable on everything when it comes to anti-aging and longevity. I also have on a good friend of mine, Luciana Pamplone, who is a lifestyle expert and also a great designer, artist, and influencer, and also one of the fittest people I know, regardless of age. So we're going to dive into what it takes to get fit over 50 if you're currently over 50 and not fit, or if you're over 50 and fit, how to be even more fit. And if you're going to be 50 soon, I know many of our listeners are, then you have something to look forward to. So welcome to my guests, Dr. Habib. Tell us how fitness may change or should change after the age of 50.
Thank you very much for inviting me. And I look forward to sharing our experiences, especially with Luciano. She has a lot to offer in both fitness and well's health. So really, the operative word is not so much your chronological age, but your biological age, you know, how you feel. You're only as old as you feel. And now we can actually measure your biological age with either telomere length, or more modern way is the epigenetic age, which is looking at the methylation pattern. So really, I think, you know, age based on your date of birth is one thing, but really how you feel is probably more important, frankly.
So if, let's say someone took one of these tests to measure their biological age and they didn't score that well, what are their next steps to, can they reduce that number down? Is it fixed? Is it malleable?
Definitely. So one of the things about the DNA, you may be born with your DNA, but the way the message, the information within the DNA, it's changing second by second, minute by minute. So to say that you have a genetic pattern that's fixed, that's incorrect. Basically, you can have the DNA for disease, and if you conduct yourself in a certain way, you can suppress disease. Conversely, if you conduct yourself in a bad way, and I'm going to elaborate on what are the bad ways that make you age, in other words, premature aging, that means that you can express the bad genes. What are the examples of bad genes that that can be expressed? Inflammation, oxidation. So when we say, you know, what are the things that can contribute to somebody's aging, you have to understand that. If you don't understand what made you older, how can you reverse it? So your question was, is it malleable? Can you reverse it? Of course you can, if you know what caused it. So as I already alluded to, inflammation will make you older. We call it inflammaging. Oxidation damages the DNA. An example of that would be sunlight. Excessive UV light gives you DNA damage on your skin and you get wrinkly, right? And so anything that damages the DNA, for example, if you're exposed to chemicals, an example would be a nuclear explosion, right? That nuclear material will damage the DNA, and that will prematurely age the individual. So inflammation, oxidation, I know 40 to 50% of your aging is genetic. That means that if you have parents that live to a 90, you could live to a 90. But living well is the next most important thing to say, right? You have the potential to get to 90 or maybe more, but how well you will you be when you get there? Hopefully you get there.
So what you, I know you see a lot of clients in your practice. What are best practices for staying fit over 50 and aging gracefully?
That's a great question. You know, when people come in, you know, they don't just come in saying, what's my biological age? And what they come in with symptoms. And your program started off that way, right? How are you feeling? Do you feel tired? Do you feel stressed? Do you feel energetic? People want to know why they're gaining weight. You know, we're talking about fit after 50. How about people who are 30 and they don't feel fit? They think that they're past it after 30. Why? Because they're gaining weight. The brain doesn't work. They wake up with a fog. They don't. Their energy seems to go up and down. Or some people after 40 think they're going to fall apart. In fact, even in our medical profession, they'll blasé mention that after 30, your growth hormone will go down. After 30, your hormones will go down. After 30, your nitric oxide, which leads to blood pressure, goes down. That's not because of age. People have allowed themselves to become prematurely old. I think people, go ahead.
Is that a belief system you're talking about too?
Well, look, there is enough evidence to say that the state of mind is part of your immune system. And so there is a little bit of science, but let's go with the really simple science, something that the regular doctors overlook. They call it placebo. So Harvard or Johns Hopkins found out what placebo is. That's why it's so hard to get above placebo. When you believe something, so you get a placebo as a sugar pill, theoretically. I hope it's not sugar, but it may be. So when you believe something, they've actually correlated to being 35% effective. That means that if you had a disorder and you believe you're getting treatment, you're going to be 35% better. So a drug becomes efficacious. That means it's FDA approved when it reaches 11% above placebo. That's why it's so hard to get drugs on the market. And when they do come, they're kind of crappy. Sorry, that's a medical term. It's just, I look down on the 11%. It just really isn't very impressive. But that's because placebo is so high. So part of why my patients do well is because they believe that I'm going to make them better because I believe I'm going to make them better. So belief, but hopefully not false belief, confident belief is part of it. So positive mindset, I think, is evidence that there is good results from it.
It's interesting because in my book, Yoga Lean, one of the seven pillars to being Yoga Lean is to believe that you can make a change, because everything starts with that belief system, whether you're talking about your weight or your health or success or happiness, peace and calm, reducing your anxiety. You have to have faith and belief. And I know, Luciana, you have a deep spiritual practice. Can you share with us how that affects this rocking body that you have?
I think it's everything I do that makes it, that makes my head and my body complete, because they're all connected. Everything's connected. So I do have a strong belief system in terms of getting up in the morning and trying to set my mind up for the day. And if you're set it where as it's going to be a really good day, I'm going to get a lot of things done, that's going to happen. But if you get up and don't think that's going to happen, it's not going to happen. But it's all based on where your head is at. You're ready to lose weight. You're ready to lose weight in your head. Your body will lose weight. It will follow, like you said. It'll totally do that.
Yeah, the body definitely follows the mind. Mm-hmm. Dr. Habib, when you have clients come in that are, and I'm assuming you see these clients that are out of shape, tired, stressed out, perhaps depressed. Other than getting blood work, do you put them on a specific protocol?
So even before blood work, I think the most important thing is to talk to the individual, because you can get a lot of information by talking, right? And there are many, very, very many good, accomplished physicians that have lots of questions. I'm kind of simple. I only have a few, so I'm going to mention what my few questions are. There are probably about five. And because they're so simple, I get kind of good answers. So the simple thing is, you know, when you wake up in the morning, do you feel rested? That's all I want to know. I don't want to know how many hours you sleep. I don't want to know what time you go into. I just want to know, do you wake up sleep? When you wake up in the morning, do you, so not only do you feel rested, do you feel any stiffness or aches and pains? Because that could be a sign of inflammation. Now, there are many reasons for inflammation. It could be from food. It can be from the, you know, microscopic or large inflammation. And then, you know, what's your energy level throughout the day? You know, a lot of people in the afternoon have to get a little something to wake them up, right? So energy should be even. And what happens is that just like the first morning awakening cortisol level, right? It's supposed to go up, right? First morning cortisol rise. But some people wake up tired because the cortisol is low. Or they start off in the morning feeling quite good, but by noon they're tired. The cortisol is low. You don't actually have to get a cortisol test. You just have to ask them. So what are you like at 3 o'clock? If you're tired, cortisol is low. And what are you like at night? You know, you kind of want the cortisol to be low. That's a trick question. Because people who have chronic fatigue syndrome, or adrenal fatigue to be precise, who are in a really bad state, not only are they low in the morning, low in the noon, low in the afternoon, they're revved up at night. They can't sleep. That's even worse than being low. So that's just an example of, you know, asking questions. You know, what do you feel like in the morning? Do you have any stiffness? What's your energy level throughout the day? Is your tummy flat, or does it feel bloated? Are you going to the bowels? Are you moving your bowels daily? Even that is a little tricky. They say, yeah, I go every day. Is it form? But when they go to the bathroom, is it the food they ate within the last 24 hours? So these are little subtleties. So those five questions are just simple, like waking up in the morning, how do you feel? Mental focus, energy, stiffness. What's your bowels like? What are the stools formed? Simple questions like that. And then I go beyond that into the skin and things like that. So good history before blood work.
So you mentioned sleep, and I wear a wearable device to try. I'm really obsessed with my sleep and have been for like the past year, making sure that I get enough deep sleep. And trying to find a rhyme or reason for those nights that I get a lot of deep sleep versus the nights that I don't. And, you know, I've had occasion where I've been, like last weekend, I was at a bachelorette party and we were out having alcohol and dancing and partying till about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. And I went to sleep at 2 a.m., which I usually try to go to sleep by like 11:30, 12 o'clock, you know, woke up 7 hours later and I had gotten a remarkably large amount of deep sleep. Now I consider myself much more of a night person than a morning person. I'll typically wake up anytime between 7 and 8 a.m. But from what I'm hearing from you, people that like myself that go like, I'm a night person, that just could be because I have reversed cortisol levels. Is that correct? Or are there some people whose biorhythms or constitution just make them more evening people than morning people?
Right. Excellent question. Excellent question. You know, and let's go back to how we started, you know, fit after 50 and, you know, talking about maybe hormones or energy or weight gain. Bottom line is, everything, the sleep precedes everything. So when you don't sleep, and we know we have evidence, people with sleep apnea have low testosterone. When you don't have sleep, you're more likely to have gut problems. So sleep is at the prerequisite to everything. Now we're going back to, are you a night person or a day person? We have some evidence. And the first evidence is, not only is there a circadian rhythm for people like you and me, physicists have discovered circadian rhythm for the universe. So it's like, if you want to defy the circadian rhythm, you're always going to lose. So what the circadian rhythm says in terms of, say, health, and one of the parameters was blood pressure. What they found was when people went to bed between 8 p.m. and 4 a.m., which I know neither one of us is going to do, they found the best blood pressure readings. Now, if you got those 8 hours sleep from midnight to 8 a.m., it wasn't so good. If you got those 8 hours of sleep from 6 p.m. to, I'm assuming, 2 a.m., it's not the same. So the circadian rhythm is, as you might imagine, when the sun goes down, you go to sleep. When the sun gets up, you know, rises, you get up. Something like that.
So recommend people such as myself, who consider themselves to be more night people, should really try and retrain themselves to go to bed earlier? Because in Ayurveda and Chinese medicine also, they say, you know, going to sleep by 10 p.m. Activates the triple warmer channel. In Ayurveda, it's, you know, supposed to be very beneficial. So there are many medicinal systems, not just Western medicine, that say, you know, sleeping at a certain hour is more beneficial.
So I was going to get there. Well, like with all studies, you know, it doesn't give you all the answers. It gives you some information. Studies are all about information. A lot of people think studies give you answers. I just want to repeat that one more time for people who have intelligent doctors that they listen to. Studies don't give answers. They give information. People with intelligence have to figure out what that information means.
Well, and that's just what we're doing here at Make America Healthy, because we've had people on from a variety of different viewpoints on different topics. Our job is to educate our listeners and give them information and then let them make the best choices for themselves. And Absolutely. A lot of times I think this is all based on trial and error.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, that's what science is there for, to keep on pushing the envelope. So I'll start by saying that of my four children, they're all different. They're all different because, well, not just physically, but even character, but their sleeping pattern is different. In other words, it's genetic. But it so happens that most people are actually day people. There are a few small group of people, and you could be one of them, where you actually function better at night. And having you go to bed early might actually cause more harm. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So I gave you an observation. My observation is that of my four children, I know which one's a morning person. I know two of them are morning people. I know that the third and fourth, they can get up if they have to, but they can easily stay up at night too. That's about 50%. But, you know, I don't think it's that high. Based on what we are figuring out, based on the circadian rhythms and people's overall health, most people do better going to bed earlier. And you don't need a doctor to tell you. All you have to do is try it out for yourself. So a couple of things is that if you just train yourself to go to bed a little bit earlier, just see how rested you are. And just to give you a quick answer, then we can go into the science. The best sleep I ever got is when I was fasted 3 days in a row. Now, I wasn't trying to fast 3 days in a row. I only fast like intermittent fasting, about 20 hours a day. It just so happens I was at a conference and it was so late, I was too tired, I just didn't want to eat. So my routine for the next 20 hours was that, you know, I'm ready to eat now. I didn't feel like eating. So it was 3 days in a row and my Oura Ring showed that I had the best deep sleep and the best REM duration that I've ever had. And I felt it too. So just to give you like an observation about, you know, what gives good sleep is try to go to sleep earlier, see for yourself. The key is not how much you slept or, you know, when you go to sleep. Is the answer would be when you wake up, do you feel rested? Then that's the right amount of sleep for you.
So along those lines, is there like a recommended amount of deep sleep and REM sleep that everyone should be trying to achieve every night? And if so, what is that number?
Yeah. Look, I've measured a lot of these things on myself, deep sleep, REM sleep, heart rate variability. I think as more data comes out, and I think the body temperature is going to be a valuable one because the brain temperature has a lot to do with the quality of sleep. When you sleep, your brain temperature goes down by 3 degrees. So if you eat too close to bedtime, you have thermogenesis. So it's harder for the brain temperature to go down. What you eat before you go to bed can also be neuroirritative. So if you have preservatives, then you're more likely to have unrested sleep. So I would say that, you know, there's more science about it. So going back to what I said about measuring, I would say that you're not in competition with other people about how much deep sleep, how much REM. It's kind of in your DNA. What you're trying to achieve is the optimum for you, if that makes sense.
Right.
So my observation was that I don't get a lot of deep sleep, but I have a lot of REM. So people who have a lot of REM are a little bit more creative. The deep sleepers may live longer. I don't know.
What do you consider a lot of REM to be? 2 hours, 3 hours?
Yeah, I'm going to be humble and tell you, I don't know. All I know is that my range, I have more REM sleep than deep sleep. And so it can range from 1 to 2 hours. Absolutely. Yeah.
Great. Let's jump over to, you know, you've got a client comes in over 50 years old, may or may not be fit. Do you recommend a specific exercise program for them? Because there are a lot of proponents of doing a lot of heavy weight training as we get older to maintain muscle mass, you know, into our more geriatric years.
Well, the first thing to say, you know, somebody accomplished like Luciana, you know, working out, is that's different to somebody who's never worked out, right? So we should really pay attention to that before we just give the science. And so the quick answer is that there's more evidence now that strength training might actually not only be beneficial in supporting the joints and the ligaments, but might be even pivotal in maintaining growth hormone, right? So that's one thing. It's a little bit like high intensive interval training. Like, you could train 1 hour every day, but the person that trains that 1 hour and incorporates high intensive interval training can not only have longevity, but they can also, you know, have better performance. So I would say that, you know, there's no one prescription for everybody. So I would say that whatever you do, you can incorporate, relatively speaking, high intensive interval training. For other people, as I said, if you are already doing strength, make sure you do enough of it, right? And
I'm going to add to that and make sure you're lifting heavy enough weights. I think women in particular are afraid of heavy weights, and they really shouldn't be.
They shouldn't be, because, you know, it's not that easy to build muscle. Dr. Atiyah, who's one of the forefront in anti-aging, what he was describing was that it really doesn't matter how much muscle you have. It's more like, are you strong? So the bottom line is, if you can still lift, as you correctly said, heavy-ish, right? That means that that will bode well for the long term, for and from an anti-aging perspective. I agree with you. I just think that people, especially females, may be more afraid that they'll bulk up. But, you know, it's not that easy to bulk up, and they should not be afraid of it.
Well, I myself am fairly muscular, and I was born with a kind of thinner, skinny frame. And I was just saying to someone yesterday, you know, past a certain age, you have three options. You can either be fat, you can either be very skinny, which really doesn't look good past a certain age, especially again on women, flappy triceps, bad posture, or I think the middle ground is just to embrace being muscular and go lift those weights.
Well, I mean, I think nowadays the fuller is more attractive, right? I think the fashion changes. So shapely is better. And yeah, I think that, you know, not only is it good at supporting your ligaments and joints, it's good for your growth hormone, growth factors. And again, I think that good shape is what we're looking for in this day and age, not the skinny that was in fashion maybe in the 80s.
So before we move on to hormones, which is a big part of fitness over 50, I'm just going to ask Luciana to share with our listeners what her daily exercise and diet routine is. And we'll post some pictures of her so you all can see how fabulous she looks.
It's so funny. And this is going to sound ridiculous, but I don't have a set workout routine. I move around a lot. I'm always like in motion. And I think that's one of the key things. If you're always in motion, you're not sitting a lot. That's the main thing. I go outside a lot. I'm inside, but outside. And I paddleboard. I still paddleboard, even though it's getting cold in the Northeast, New York area. We're in Eastern Long Island, so I'm in the water. Even that is good for you, that shock of 60 degrees, 65 degree water.
If you fall off your paddleboard.
No, just walking in through the paddleboard, just taking the paddleboard is 27 pounds. So I'm lifting that, and I alternate my arms. That's my only really arm workout, is lifting.
And you go to the gym during the winter.
Yeah, during the winter, I'll go to the gym, but I don't lift a lot of weights. I do more abs, and I dance. I'm doing a tap dance class tomorrow with a neighbor. It's pretty funny. That's never done tap dancing, but I love dancing. So, and I try to incorporate many many things, not just one thing, into my daily activities. So I'm like a rare, I don't know, hybrid of things.
Movement.
Yeah.
And you're also very low carb.
Yes. In terms of what I eat, like before I came over here, I was like, let me have a snack. So I had some cheese and I had some low carb crackers, but I eat more of a low carbohydrate diet. And that I did lose about 25 pounds about 6 years ago doing that. And I like my body in this way. So I'm, and it's very easy. It takes basically three days to adapt to a lower carb diet. For me, it didn't take long. It's just making choices throughout the day. So it's not really, I don't want to call it a diet. It's more of a
lifestyle.
It's a lifestyle. It's just the way I live. So I'll have, say, protein for, I try to have as much protein as I can, but once in a while I can feel my body crave like a carbohydrate. So I'll have a low carb cracker. So
it's, one cracker, no listeners, no, just one
no,
cracker.
No, I don't. People think I work out a lot and on strict diet. I'm not. I think that's how I metabolize.
But you know, it's over the course of a lifetime of activity.
Yes,
you know,
I'm very active.
I think that, and I've been fortunate. I've been working out in the gym since age 15, so I have good muscle bellies and good muscle memory. But for people who are starting a strength training regime later in life, I think it becomes more challenging for them, you know.
But also, like we said earlier in life, I was a competitive athlete.
Yeah.
So if you're a competitive athlete, your muscle memory, like you just said.
So for those of you listening who have children, make sure they are moving. Mm-hmm. And if you have daughters, I advocate for sending them to the gym as soon as they're 15, 16 years old to get those habits formed, or
dance class.
Get those, or yoga. You know, we can talk about yoga as such a great way to feel comfortable in the body that you're in, no matter what that body is. That's one of the things we teach through our Yoga Lean program at Yoga Fit, is to just learn to love movement, get comfortable being uncomfortable, and also embrace the body that you're in and practice with that body that you have today, not the one you had 10 years ago, because, you know, we have to start to make adaptations as we get older. And those adaptations may include lifting heavier weights. My personal goal is to get stronger as I get older. So I'm constantly pushing myself in the gym to lift a little heavier. So let's tie that in with hormone health, Dr. Habib, because I know that, and I had the personal experience this past summer, I was severely depressed, actually having suicidal ideation. I was off my antidepressant medication. But then when I went to my functional medicine doctor and got a blood test, he was like, you have no testosterone or very low. So I've had to start supplementing with testosterone and I'm feeling better.
Yeah. I mean, that's it's good to share, you know, personal experiences. And I just want to go back to activity, because in the audience, we have a variety of people. It's great if you were active when you were young, because you can always kind of get back to it. But if you've never been active, there's hope for you, because what we find is that people who stand for 8 hours versus people who don't, they live longer. So it's very simple. Just stand. Then if you're standing, move. And so it's really not rocket science. The people who are centenarians, the blue zones, the people that live to 100, they were not athletes. These are not marathon runners. What they found was that in an average day, they were active. They weren't sitting around. They tend to be standing, moving, just walking. And only 1 hour in a day, they would maybe be vigorous. Their example of being vigorous is, you know, like old-fashioned, go down and pick up the fish that they fished and then bring it back up the hill. It sounds very romantic. That's why I mentioned it. So you don't have to be a super athlete. It's good if you started off that way, because you can regain it, you know. And it's simple locomotion is what I want to say. And that's kind of what I wanted to bring up when we started talking about high-intensity training and so forth. Just the main thing is, find an activity that you like, because then you can sustain it. If it's a gym, you may not sustain it. If it's basketball or, you know, kicking the soccer ball, that's great. Because if you like something, you're more likely to carry it out. So that's very, very important. It's for the long haul. Now, let's get back to the very serious subject here. You talk about depression. You talk about low testosterone. So when we talk about hormones, people tend to go to the sex hormones. But, you know, there is another hormone called thyroid. That's pretty important. And let's go one step before that, because this, what I'm about to mention, it's like an infomercial. I'm going to keep you guessing. What I'm about to tell you, if you keep tuned, is that there may be even a master hormone. And I'm not talking about growth hormone as much as that's a master hormone. I'm talking about insulin. Insulin resistance and how it regulates hormones downstream is especially important. But let's keep it simple. So as I was telling our guests here, that testosterone is a steroid. Your body makes a steroid not only for growth, but for repair. Cortisol is a steroid. It is to help you, particularly when you wake up in the morning. So why does the cortisol rise in the morning? It rises because you need to raise your heart rate and blood pressure. Otherwise, you'd collapse when you got out of bed, because at night, it's a very low level, right? So you have the maximum rise in cortisol, and then it comes down to a reasonable amount and kind of stays lowish, but not too low. That's for another occasion. We can talk about cortisol and how it's supposed to be. But there is an analogy between cortisol and testosterone. They're both steroids. Steroids, from a medical terminology, is to repair the body. So when you have chronic stress, depression is a stress because it affects your sleep, your mood, your optimism in life. If you have insomnia or sleep apnea, that's a stress on the body. Endurance athletes, how many of those are illegally using testosterone replacement therapy because they think that's an edge? It's not an edge. They're all low T, because endurance athletes have a disproportionately high numbers of low testosterone level. So in summary, the commonality of all of these people is chronic stress makes the body turn to its steroid stores, namely testosterone being one of them, which leads to the low T. So I'm not against replacing the testosterone to make your body feel better, because it can makes your muscles stronger, your bones stronger, your cognition. If your body's feeling good, you're more active in the day, you're more rested, so your sleep will be better. And if you're active in the day and you're sleeping better, your mood is better. So we know that diet and exercise helps with mood, right? Just like Prozac. So I think it's all related, but we must always try to, as Luciana mentioned, you know, she's somebody that doesn't vigorously exercise necessarily, but she's always been active. She has a healthy lifestyle. She, you know, puts importance on sleep and movement and activity and being happy, being, you know, what's the word you use to keep your immune system strong? Positive thinking, right?
Yes.
So going back to testosterone, we need to understand that you have a range. And the idea is to be within the range. So if you're below the range, it's common sense. Let's get it back on the range. So I'm okay with that. If it's above the range, you got to ask yourself what that is. There's something called Cushing syndrome. That means too much cortisol. So too much cortisol is not necessarily good. Too little cortisol is not good. That's called Addison's. And doctors only know disease. So apparently, if you don't have disease, then you're normal, which is wrong. There's different levels of normal, right? There's a high-functioning normal, high function. And over time, as we know, the function must go down somewhat. But what doctors don't know is that before you get disease, you have dysfunction. That's when patients say, you know, I have no energy. I can't seem to lose weight. I have, you know, more pigmentation on my face. My hair is thinning. These are the symptoms. Remember I said history is more important than labs? You can get the diagnosis from the history. That's the function going down. And when the function goes down, you still don't have a blood test that says disease. Because even when it goes to the dysfunction, that's when people complain, because it's dysfunctional. I have no energy. My joints hurt. I'm stiff. I'm bloated and so forth. And if you don't address dysfunction, then you get disease. That's when the doctor thinks he's picked it up early. It's not early by any standards. Mm. So, I mean, just to finish off on the testosterone stories, that I think getting into the range, and it'll be a debate about how high the testosterone level should be in somebody who's 80 versus somebody who's 20. By the way, I told you, 20-year-old athletes have low testosterone, so it's not healthy for them. So they need to get back up there, but they need to ask themselves, why is it low, before they get on a treatment plan?
So I listened to a lot of podcasts, and I was listening to David Sinclair out of Harvard, who claims, and he's in his 50s, he claims he keeps his testosterone levels somewhere close to 1,000, just with diet and exercise. And, you know, perhaps he's leading a completely stress-free life, but I'm wondering, is this even possible, Dr. Habib?
Yeah. So listen, Dr. Sinclair is very a smart guy. He looks good. He's studying anti-aging, and he's come up with some remarkable information. So what I'll tell you, just like your biological age, 50 or 60% is genetic, right? You can't change that. It's kind of like, you know, some families live a long time and some don't, right? Science can play with it a little bit. And Dr. Sinclair is trying to find the sirtuins and things at the molecular level that can extend that, that it doesn't matter what happened to your family, right? And I think there's a truth in that one. Now, just like everything else, not everybody has the same levels. So it's important to ideally know what your optimal levels were, right? I'm going to repeat that, but it's a very important concept. It's important to know what your optimal is, because you don't know. You're not competing with anybody else. We have a range. It's called a reference range. It's not called a normal range. Why? Because 95% of the population has to fit in that range. So it's not accurate to say everybody with 1,000, because the range doesn't start at 1,000. The range starts from 500 for men to about 1,400, right? Why is there a range? Because some people are lower and some people are higher, and you don't know what normal is, because it's not called a normal range, it's called a reference range. So someone like me who's tested earlier on, I would know what my range was. So now I can compare and say, now that I'm 54 almost, where am I compared to my so-called optimal, if that was the case? You were going to ask me something.
So what I'm understanding from you is the importance of getting regular blood work, which we always advocate all of our listeners to do. At what age should people really start to pay attention to their blood work? So they're going to have historicals so that they can make more informed decisions about where they were.
Absolutely. Two things. One is as early as you can, but not only blood tests, what kind of blood test? If you're looking for a blood test from your doctor, those are disease blood tests. In other words, you can't find out function generally unless you know how to interpret one or two of them. You have to do functional testing.
So you make a good point. You know, when clients come to me and they're like, I'm going to go get blood work done, I say, make sure you get all of your hormone levels checked, as well as your DHEA levels and your growth hormone levels. Am I missing anything?
No, I mean, but that's a hormonal function. How about your vascular function? How about your liver function? Not disease, not like fatty liver or elevated liver enzyme. Well, how do you measure the function of the liver? Not from the enzymes that get damaged and leak into the blood, which we call the liver function test, LFTs, being elevated. Lipitor can do that. But actually, one of the signs of function of the liver is the production of glutathione. So you have to understand that we need to know not only the function of the hormones, we need to know the function of the brain, the function of the heart, the function of the blood vessels. So I call it your biological age, your functional age. And just because you have a biological age that's young doesn't guarantee that every single organ is of the same age. Because generally, depending on genetics and how you conduct yourself, they can all be somewhat different. So I'll try to keep it simple. What if somebody has a really young biological age and everybody in their family lives to 90? Well, I have something to a spanner in the works for those people. What if you get a heart attack before then and die? How will you get to 90? So what I'm trying to say is that just because you look young, just because you have a young biological age, which I used to have, it's changed a little bit now. The point is, there's no guarantee, because each of the systems have value. Not to underestimate telomere length and the epigenetic age, but that's just data points and a very good one. But you need to look at the overall functional capacity of the different systems, and collectively you get a better picture. It's like pieces in a puzzle. And if one or two pieces are missing, you don't get the full picture. Just to reiterate, the disease number testing, the disease tests are not to be mistaken for functional tests. In fact, what is better is to have both of them, because sometimes you can pick up disease. Other times you can see the function is going down and you can predict disease. So one of the things that I do is rethink medicine, and this plug for myself, because what I believe is when you're rethinking medicine, you should be able to predict, prevent, and prolong life.
So on those notes, I know there's a lot of new diagnostic testing available and a lot of new technology that can detect cancer 10 years out. Can you let our listeners know about any advances in terms of testing that they should be looking for?
100%. So let's go with the standard of care, right? So if you're around 50, now it's 45, you should get a colonoscopy. Why? Because if you have a polyp, you can get rid of it before it ever becomes cancer. I've had two colonoscopies already. Well, I'm not too fond of mammograms, but don't let people walk away and not do it. I'm just going to give you information, right? Mammogram. Well, by the time you see a change on the mammogram, billions of cells have already formed. By the time you see changes on an MRI of the breast, she would say, which is more accurate, much more accurate than a mammogram, millions of cells have already formed. So now it can lead to what you're saying. Is there a test out there that can look at cancer before it's already formed? because, you know, oncologists probably still to this day believe you can't see it. It's not there. That's not true. Cancers don't just appear. They mutate and they have a cell cycle. And when the number of cancer cells balances with normal cells, you still don't have cancer. But when the number of mutated cells exceeds the normal cells in that surrounding tissue, now you have the beginning of it. Still not visible on an MRI, by the way. But you know, so you get the drift, right? So it's a process. And so the thing is that with cancer, we want to pick it up at the blood level, at the DNA level.
And would that be like a CA125 test?
That's old school. Okay. Sorry, I'm just a little too direct.
I'm not a doctor, so.
That's all right. I know. That's okay. Look, that's like what an average doctor would say. Well, you know, we did the blood test, everything's negative. Mere absence of disease doesn't make everything normal. You got to have the right test to even make a claim that everything's normal. So when you're looking at the DNA, we call that cell-free DNA. And there is a certain pattern of DNA in that cell-free DNA. That means that your cells have been stripped out of all the other ingredients, and it's just the certain DNA that's consistent with the pattern of a certain cancer. So there are about 50 of these that the lab is called Galeri, G-A-L-L-E-R-I, plug for them. They don't pay me anything. So the thing is that, would you rather get a diagnosis on a CAT scan, an MRI, a mammogram, or an ultrasound, or would you rather have a DNA test that tells you that there's a high likelihood of mutations in up to 50 of the most common cancers, because then you have a chance to do something about it because cancer hasn't actually presented itself in the official manner, right? From a regular doctor's diagnosis. And so the point is that there are labs out there. That's another, I mean, I can't call it really a functional lab, but it kind of is, right? You're predicting it, that if you don't do something, these DNA patterns, we call it hypermethylation pattern. In fact, new studies are showing that if you're hypomethylating, so what is methylation? Methylation is something that's going on every day without you even thinking about it. And one of the primary organs is the liver. That's why it's so important for our listeners to understand a healthy liver doesn't stop when your average doctor says your liver enzymes are okay. That's the lowest level.
So I'd like to just pause you and ask a question that I know we're getting some messages sent to us via the chat. People are asking about alcohol, liver health, what you tell your clients. You know, Andrew Huberman keeps putting out podcasts, how bad alcohol is for you. I'm curious as to your thoughts when you have clients coming in who may be, you know, frequent consumers of alcohol.
Well, first of all, I try to be nice to people, so I don't scare the hell out of them on the first visit. I wait for the second visit. Okay. Just kidding. I don't do that. So look, the facts are the facts. So the evidence shows that there is increase. If you look at medical facts, there's an increase in men and women in the incidence of cancer when they consume just even one unit, right? But I'm going to go into the biochemistry a little bit for you. So basically, it has to be metabolized through the liver. And the number one toxin for the liver is alcohol. I measure these things. And one of the markers, which is actually a simple blood test, called the gamma GT or GGT. So if anybody wants to go to their regular doctor and measure the GGT, if I have somebody who consumes a large amount of alcohol, it'll be hundreds, right? The upper limit for men is 60. The upper limit of women is 40. But the point is that we don't want to wait till the upper limit. The best level is when, I told you, even conventional labs can be interpreted. This is one of them. If it's less than 20, it's actually a good number. That means that you don't have as much toxic burden on the liver. So if I first start off by saying alcohol is a toxin, it's a burden on the liver. And when you have a burden on the liver, remember, methylation, it goes on in the liver. And it's a very key area because that methylation can be for detoxification. That methylation can be for gene expression, that your DNA now knows what to do or what not to do. Hence why hypermethylation, that's all we can say, is not a good thing because it's associated with more cancers. Now, they've looked at the pattern and say, if it's these patterns, it could be any of these top 50 cancers. They're going to come up with studies to show that hypomethylation is also dangerous. So the idea is that you've got to be somewhere in the middle and you don't control it. Your liver controls it. So if you can't control it, the only thing you can control is your diet and what you drink. So if the evidence shows that drinking even as little as one unit can increase the risk of cancer in men and women, And now I'm telling you how important the liver is, and that liver is the central organ for methylation, and it regulates itself. We can only tell you the good pattern and the bad pattern. That's all we can tell you right now. We can't tell you any more than that. Now, I do things to support the liver and make the liver's numbers more functional. And the way I measure it is having low gamma GT levels, lower normal range in the AST, ALT, and high levels of glutathione at the very least.
So what are your thoughts on supplementing glutathione via IV drips and intramuscular injection of glutathione? And I ask because I do both of those things.
Well, you are a smart lady and you can make all the statements and claims you want. But as a physician, because there's lots of listeners, I have to make a disclaimer. And you know, this is for education purposes, for information only. Whatever we say is not a diagnosis or treatment. You must go to your doctor. That said, I have a lot of experience delivering high-dose glutathione, 100% safe. The number one thing to support the liver, and all I can tell you is that I have repeat data after data after data, that it can reverse fatty liver disease in my office. So I have numbers to show before and after. That's how I tell people. Or at the very least, the liver enzymes that are elevated, which most of it's associated with fatty liver, is reduced. And that the glutathione can not only support the liver and its ability to detoxify. When people come with melasma, that means pigmentation in the skin, their pigmentation gets better. When the people come in and they have problems with autoimmunity, like thyroid disease, amongst other testing that I do, like food inflammation and vitamin levels and then replacement or act upon the results, you start to regulate the immune system. So the antibodies that would damage the thyroid no longer damage because the antibody levels go down. Again, before the test, the antibodies were high. After my program, the antibodies are down. So I'm not telling people it's a treatment because apparently only drugs can treat, but I'm just telling you that these natural protocols can actually show evidence of results of improving autoimmunity. An example would be thyroid. And when you have autoimmunity, you get weird things like pigmentation and joint problems. And so those also get better.
So on the note of drugs, how harmful are pharmaceutical drugs to the liver?
Well, bottom line is we call it the first pass metabolism. In other words, when you eat something, food even, or a drug, it has to be absorbed through the gut lining. The first pass means they can only go through the liver first. So the liver is a really important place. It gets hammered a lot. And so there's good and bad. So when we want a drug to work, it has to go through the first pass. That means it'll be metabolized by something called cytochrome P450. We have to factor that in to make sure that compound, the drug, then gets into the bloodstream and then has an impact. So it's no surprise that many drugs have an impact on the liver. Most drugs are metabolized by the liver. There are smaller exceptions that are metabolized by the kidney. And one of those is an antibiotic called fluoroquinolone. So we have to monitor kidney function before we give such a drug. And sometimes we have to monitor liver function before we give certain drugs. So antifungal. So
would you say that pharmaceuticals are more damaging to the liver than alcohol, or is alcohol more damaging?
They're all different because each one taxes the system in a different way. So cytochrome P450, it sounds like one thing. There are so many cytochrome P450 variations because the evolution of the liver is such that it's been able to address a lot of things. And so all I say is that they're different. Cumulatively, they can be bad. So you are somebody that's... So what happens when we take an antibiotic or antifungal, we say don't drink alcohol. Why? Because they'll have double impact on the liver in a negative way. So that's why we say it. But we can't actually predict it beyond just telling people that it'll be worse for you.
Well, just wrapping up our conversation about liver health, we had Dr. Edward Group on the show a couple of times, and he said that most people's livers functioning at about 15-20%. I actually... did their liver cleanse after Dry January last year, and probably will do another one.
Well, you know, so I can't be that precise because I'm a physician, so I have to be very careful about giving hard numbers. All I can tell you is that if you want to make clinical improvements in anything and everything, you must have a healthy gut and a healthy liver, which then communicate with the immune cells inside the body. We call that the visceral area. And that's why the visceral fat is not a fat just to accumulate and give you trouble. It's part of the communication between the gut microbes, the immune cells in the fat in a good way, and the liver. So, you know, a conventional doctor just can't get their head around, well, you know, if you don't have a disease, you know, if it's not inflammatory bowel disease, you don't have cirrhosis, you know, you're not overweight, then yeah, hey, what's the problem? It's like, you know, the mere absence of disease doesn't make it normal. So I was just confirming to you about the doctor who said 20%, that the liver and the gut, because you can't have a good liver if your gut is not good, generally speaking. You cannot have a good immune system if your gut and the liver are out of whack. So I would say that I would probably agree with him, but I can't give you a fixed number because that's too precise. And I don't know that we have evidence to give that number. However, I'll tell you that most people are underfunctioning because their doctor's probably telling them that, hey, your liver enzymes are normal. A mere absence of elevated liver enzymes does not mean your liver is normal. A good example of the functional state is a low gamma GT, which is a very standard test, and a high intracellular glutathione level, which is not a standard test. So people who make statements about it, unless they're measuring, they don't know. So basically, most people are not even average. They're all fairly low, including myself, because our bodies are constantly having to deal with free radicals. So for example, because I know that I've measured heavy metals, which I've done chelation and most of it's out, but if you have toxins in your body, your glutathione is going to be consumed because it's constantly trying to help eliminate those toxins.
Right. You mentioned visceral fat. As we're moving towards the close of the show, let's talk about the importance of doing some type of a body scan, like an in-body or something that measures your percentage of body fat versus your percentage of lean muscle mass. And I, you know, over 33%, I know is technically obese in terms of percentage of body fat. Are there any recommendations you have for these levels, men and women over 50 years old?
Well, you've hit on the common stuff, but I want to, because we have very few limited time, I want to actually give you the science. Okay. So yes, if your BMI is over 30, men, women, it's bad. That's such low level stuff. What I'm telling you is that you can have two people who are fat. One is healthy, one is unhealthy. You can measure the adiponectin. The healthy person has adequate amounts of adiponectin. Adiponectin is a positive peptide that keeps the insulin resistance down, which means that likelihood of toxins being down, likelihood of inflammation being down. You can have an equally fat person. It doesn't really matter because, you know, it's very difficult to measure visceral fat unless you do a special scan, a special MRI scan. So people doing your body bioimpedance is low level. That's not real science. I'm not saying it's not good to track, but nobody can give a firm diagnosis of, hey, you have visceral fat. What I'm trying to tell you, it's much easier to understand, is if you, doesn't matter about your weight, provided you're healthy and you measure your adiponectin, that's a much better gauge of the quality of fat. If you have good quality fat, your insulin resistance will be down, inflammation will be down, you'll be much more healthy.
Great. Just three bullet points on what our listeners can do to be more fit over 50 as we're about to wrap the show.
Well, I mean, it goes back to my five pillars, you know. Don't damage your sleep. I say damage because most people choose to go to bed late and not sleep properly. And then make sure you don't put the bad things in. Those toxins interfere with receptors. Those toxins put pressure on your immune system. Then put the good stuff in. And then obviously, you know, supplement where you can. And then number five would be seeing doctors like us who will optimize you.
Great. Luciana, any words of wisdom for our listeners?
Just stay positive. Just stay positive because the mind controls everything.
Wonderful. Well, we'd like to thank Dr. Habib and Luciana Pamplone. We will put their contact information in our show notes, so please make sure you check them out on social media as well as their websites. And we'd like to thank our sponsors, YogaFit Training Systems, the leader in yoga, mind, body, fitness education. Please visit yogafit.com to check out conferences, workshops, trainings, and online classes. And you can save 15% at checkout by using the code VOICE22. Please visit me on Instagram at Beth Shaw Health. You can message me through my website, bethshaw.com. And until next time, we'd like to wish everyone a healthy, happy day. And thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed this show, please share it and stay healthy and stay positive, everyone. Namaste.
Thanks for joining us on Make America Healthy. We hope we've given you some tools you need to take back control of your health. Until next time, we wish you a healthy and wonderful week.